This is 1330 WRCA Watertown, Boston.
Good evening. It's Tube Talk on WRCA Radio, 1330 AM. That's My Reverie with Larry Clinton, B. Wayne on the vocal, and isn't that sweet? What a nice, sweet little high note finish there. Certainly a little bit sweeter than my voice. This is Tube Talk on WRCA 1330 AM. Thank you for joining us this evening. You have reached the zenith of the independently produced radio experience. We are on the air broadcasting on the glorious standard broadcast band and on the net streaming for your listening enjoyment. Let's throw the Hudson Hornet into reverse and go back and listen to... Thank you. Getting sentimental over you, Tommy Dorsey. And, you know, I just want to totally disassociate myself from that wannabe staff announcer who ran in here and took the microphone and did that crazy announcement. His name is Gaylord P. Farquhar, and he's been just begging me to get on the show. He's this frustrated staff announcer type, and he wants to get on, and, you know, I don't think I'm going to let him on. So, anyway, I just wanted to get that straight. We're very pleased tonight on Tube Talk to have Ross Hochstrasser joining us, and we're going to have a conversation about communications receivers. We're going to answer the eternal question, what are they, why do we like them, why should we listen to them? And just to give you a little background on Ross, he's been on the show before. He is the special events chairman of the New England Antique Radio Club, all-around radio enthusiast and just swell radio guy who's volunteered his time to come on and talk with us. So thanks for coming on, Ross.
No, you're quite welcome, Paul.
And, you know, we've talked a lot about a lot of different topics and different types of radios, and we've talked about vacuum tubes. But one thing we haven't really devoted any time to on the show is the world of communications receivers, which I know is something that's near and dear to your heart. So maybe you could just start out by telling the audience, you know, they call these things boat anchors, communications receivers. What exactly is a communications receiver?
Well, a communications receiver is a type of receiver that was designed for a very high sensitivity operation, for reliable and drift-free operation, and for operation maybe under less than ideal conditions. The communications receiver world started probably back in the 1930s. Where the military was looking for radios, and also to a very limited degree, the ham radio world was also looking for some high-quality receivers. And although ham radio operators typically didn't have lots of money to spend, these radios were still very expensive. One of the first boat anchors that I ever owned, I acquired back when I was in high school, was a 1936 RCA AR-60. A friend of mine found it in the local town dump, and we dragged it back home to my house, and I was able to actually get it working. it was kind of a mess, and that it had been sitting outside for a while, and I think a cat had marked his territory on it. And,
cats.
We had to deal with that. It was awful. But the radio has left my possession, and I don't know where it is, and I don't remember where it went. We moved out of our house in Weymouth, and I never saw the radio again, and I can't remember if I sold it or whatever. But either way, that radio in $1936 dollars was $495, which was an awful lot of money. I think a brand new car was only about $800, so it was a very expensive radio. But these radios were designed for maximum performance, maximum sensitivity, high selectivity, the ability to single stations out in a pileup, and typically also had a BFO, beat frequency oscillator, which was used to decipher Morse code. And the term boat anchor was actually given to these radios probably in the 1960s. One of the contributing factors to the existence of these radios was that at the end of World War II, the government was selling off war surplus. And ham operators, again, not having big budgets to work with, were able to buy war surplus radios for very, very short money.
Yeah, that was big.
To modify these radios and do what they needed to get them on the air and get them usable. And transmitters also were included in that. And I think as technology became more and more miniaturized and lightweight and so forth, the usefulness of these communications receivers and transmitters was such that they were getting relegated to the junk heaps in favor of the little solid-state radios that were made by Kenwood and Yaesu and ICOM and all that sort of thing. And the name boat anchor kind of stuck to these radios at that point because they were considered to be inferior to the solid-state stuff, although I don't believe that they are, and most people don't. But in a nutshell, that's where these radios found their infancy and how they got into the hands of people like me and other enthusiasts who have come to realize that these radios are important not only historically but also technically because they really were the best radios that money could buy in their day.
Yeah, and, you know, it's funny that you mentioned, they come in to the hands of the amateurs after World War II. You know, and there was a lot of stuff in the pipeline that all these different radio companies had been making for the government that when the war was over had to find a home. You know, and not only was we were able to get good radios, but there were millions upon millions of tubes that were being manufactured for the government, and those started, you know, when the war was over, the contracts are up. Yeah, they kept buying some for maintenance, but it was just a bonanza for the amateur because you could get tubes and speakers and parts and all this stuff that was destined to go to the military. You know, the purchase orders get canceled and the stuff just shows up. And, you know, one other thing I just wanted to ask you, though, to make it a communications receiver, we're still talking here that these are primarily a listening-type receiver, right? We're not talking a transmitter-slash-receiver like you would find in a ham shack.
No. These radios are standalone receivers that could be used in conjunction mm-hmm. with a transmitter, but they were not typically a transceiver unit. The technology wasn't miniaturized enough at that point in time to make a transceiver that was operational. So these are standalone receivers only, generally speaking, and the most common receiver that was bought up war surplus after World War II was the BC-348 and the BC-312, which the BC-348 is the one that was always seen in the B-17s, B-24s, even into the B-29s. B-25s. A lot of the aircraft during World War II used the BC-348, and you still see them coming up on eBay at this point. Radios that have been had holes drilled in them, had S meters added to them, and extra knobs on them, and all kinds of stuff. But when you were buying a radio in the 1950s, 1960s for $2, it didn't command a lot of respect. So hams would buy them and drill holes in them and make modifications and use them. And they were pretty decent radios. They weren't fantastic, but they were pretty decent radios. And the other very common World War II surplus radio was the ARC-5 system. Those were the command sets that we used to communicate back and forth between airplanes, not necessarily between the airplane and ground, but between planes. They were called command sets, and they were the ARC-5 series. And you find lots of those around. It's very difficult these days to find ARC-5 equipment and BC-348s that haven't been butchered and hacked up by hams who were using them. But again, they were buying them for pennies on the dollar. And, again, they didn't command a whole lot of respect because of that.
Yeah, it's similar to somebody who might buy, you know, a junker at a yard sale. It's, you know, a broadcast radio, you know, a nice Zenith AM-FM. The case is all smashed or whatever. But if you're trying to learn repair or you want a practice set or you need some parts and you can get one for a couple of bucks, you know, it doesn't really matter what you do to it. So one of the other things I was going to ask, most of these are going to require a headset to listen to or an external speaker, correct?
Most of these radios are perfectly capable of driving a speaker. Most of them also have headphone jacks, so you can operate them either way. Depending upon what the application of the radio was, they usually have a pretty decent audio output stage. Most of the Collins series, like the I-390s, 398s, that were used for surveillance, typically were just driving either a tape recorder or a set of headphones. There wasn't any real requirement for big audio coming out of these radios, but there are numerous websites out there that devote themselves to modifying the audio in a lot of these big boat anchor radios to get a more high fidelity type of sound out of them. And some of them just sound great by themselves. I have sitting a foot from my elbow here is one of my R392s, which was a post-World War II, about 1952 vintage communications receiver designed to run on 24 volts to 28 volts DC. And it's essentially a miniaturized, ruggedized version of the Collins R390. And that radio has push-pull audio output, and the audio output on most of these radios is a 600-ohm output, so you need a matching transformer to use it with a speaker. But the R392 really is a very sweet-sounding radio. And when you look at it, it's this olive drab green little box, and it weighs about 50 pounds, and you don't equate it with high fidelity sound, but it really does sound pretty good.
Yeah, I mean, anybody who's looking for a pretty wood cabinet to look at is not going to go off into the world of communications receivers to find one. They're generally large, very metal looking, green, gray. What else have you seen? I've seen all kinds of color combinations. You know, they're not. But you know, to the collector who prizes them, they are actually quite pretty. And I have a fellow who's down in Texas who just posted on one of his club websites one of his favorite. I think it's a Hallicrafters he's restored. And he's very fond of the way it looks at night. So he has, you know, the dark and pictures taken. Would you say that there's a requirement for band coverage that you'd have to have on your radio to get into the communications receiver club? Are we looking at all waves or just multi-band? Is the standard broadcast band going to show up on most of these?
Most of them do have the standard broadcast band. You run into certain radios here and there that don't have it. A radio that I've been doing some restoration work on recently is a Hammerland SP-200. And the SP-200 was also known in military terms as a BC-779. And the SP-200 that I have does cover the broadcast band, but in the collection that this came from, there was another one that skipped the broadcast band. They had a band that covered 200 to 500 200 to 500 kilohertz, and then skipped over the broadcast band and started at 2 megahertz and jumped all the way up to 30 megahertz from there. And they did that primarily to have some coverage down in the long wave band, which as far as I know, was used by submarines and long-range telegraph-type communications.
Yeah, I just interesting. I subscribe to a newsletter for a different club. We belong to the New England Antique Radio Club, but I like to read other people's letters too. And there's this one club that has this little, you know, it's called the reflector. You bounce things back and forth between club members. And this is one guy. I guess they have a facility where they set up little museum-type exhibits, and he's actually looking for, I have no idea what the type of communications receiver would have been in a tank, but he is looking one that was from a tank, some, you know, hopefully around World War II vintage. The people that have asked him to do this exhibit have asked for one, so he's sent out an all points bulletin. I have no idea what would show up in a tank. So we're talking on ships, planes, tanks, ground communications in the military. Where would you have found those in their heyday when they were used for specifically the military?
Oh, all of the above.
All of the above?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I don't know very much about tank communications. I know that during the Korean War period, they were up around 70 to 80 megahertz, I think, in the tank radios, or maybe starting around 30 megahertz and going up from there. So I'm not real familiar with that particular mode of operation, but I'm sure that the tanks during World War II probably had some of the high-frequency communications gear that the aircraft did as well. I would think they would have had to. The frequency coverage of these radios, generally speaking, the top end is around 30 megahertz, but during World War II, they were starting to experiment with VHF, and you did see some VHF stuff. And again, VHF meaning maybe 30 to 50 or 30 to 80 megahertz, somewhere in there you started seeing some of that type of equipment being used. But we don't see too much of it, really, in the boat anchor world. you know, we're more general coverage type radios, which was very convenient when it was all being sold as war surplus, because it was very useful. You know, a ham could pick one of these up, or a shortwave listener if they had the inclination to purchase one of these things. They make great shortwave listening receivers. Most of these radios, again, well, virtually all of them have BFOs on them, B frequency oscillators for listening to Morse code. And with a little bit of finessing, you can back off the RF gain control and listen to single sideband on them as well. Single sideband did not exist during World War II. That was an invention that came after the war. And these radios weren't designed specifically to listen to single sideband, but you can certainly do it.
Yeah, you know, in one of my favorite books, Discover DXing, which is put out, I guess, through National Radio out in Universal Radio out in Ohio, they had a little chapter in there, you know, for people interested in getting started in DXing, you know, and they talk about different, you know, standard commercial sets you could get that are hot on AM. But then, you know, they make a little section at the end and they say, and if you can get your hands on some surplus, and then they, you know, mention maybe you can get yourself a nice Hammerland or a Collins or a Drake, and you can do your shortwave listening and you can do your AM broadband DXing on that. And they recommend them highly. With the, what type of antenna do you need to really to pick up a good signal for communications? Long wire, standard long wire, you can make at home?
Generally speaking, a good old length of wire, you know, 60, 70, 75 feet, 100 feet, is pretty good. And most of these radios respond well to that. My telephone's making a funny noise here. The ultimate antenna I have found for shortwave listening and also for use in ham use is a loop antenna, and it responds very well, and it's a very quiet antenna. There's very little noise that comes through. The way that it was explained to me last week by somebody that I was talking to is that every radio wave has two components. It has an electrical component and a magnetic component. And the loop antenna primarily responds to the magnetic component, and your atmospheric noise and electrical noise tends to exist in the electrical component. And that's why loop antennas tend to be very quiet. But loop antennas is something that, even though I've got my Delta loop up in the air, and I use it for transmitting and receiving. There are other types of loop antennas that you can actually make tunable and put next to your radio and use it to select out noise and to peak up performance. And that's another whole subject for another day. But the loop antennas were very popular back in the 1920s. You used to see very beautiful decorative loop antennas on top of the old black the blackface multi-dial sets.
Yeah, there's a lot of guys that like to make those. You know, they get a little bit of a woodworker and a radio hobby going on, and I've seen some very nice ones, some replicas that they've made, you know, because they'll find something and they'll use that as a plan, or if they can actually find a old instruction or a diagram, and they, some of them are quite nice, and they, it gives that 20 set a real feel for, you know, what you would see. You know, it gives it that real, and if operationally, if the set's restored, I'm sure it probably works pretty well. From DXing, DXing point of view, on your own, what's your best catch lately? Did you survive the solar expulsion a couple of weeks ago? I mean, how was your reception with the current state of affairs in the air?
Yeah, well, it's kind of interesting. It varies from day to day, depending upon what volume of CME is interfering with us. But I didn't really notice too much of a problem. It was one day or 2 days where it was a little bit quieter than normal. I don't always go DXing on the shortwave bands every day, but I do it quite often. I listen to standard broadcast AM most of the time in the morning, and then shift around and try to pick up Alex Jones or WBCQ or something in the afternoon. But it varies. I didn't really notice all that much of a difference, although lately, the last couple of days, things have been pretty hot on the shortwave bands. I've been able to pick up quite a few stations pretty easily here.
Yeah, it's I've noticed that things are kind of, I think the season's turning, and a lot of things are kind of turning a little bit as far as reception. I mentioned to you that I had some good results a couple of weeks ago, and, you know, it's a good time to try out your sets if you've been a little lazy and you haven't been listening or you haven't been staying up late enough at night. Especially you can get good results, I know, early in the morning, right around sunrise and right around sunset. Sometimes you get some very interesting catches because of, you know, the way the ionosphere is reforming itself. And you mentioned something to me that I was not aware of. I know that the characteristics of the ionosphere change as far as how it will conduct a signal, and we're all familiar with the idea of skip. But what you were telling me is that seasonally, actually, the height where the ionosphere begins changes a little bit, and maybe you could share with the audience some information on that. I had not been aware of that.
No. Well, I'm not really an expert. I should be, because I am a licensed ham operator, but I don't really pay a lot of attention to it. But the ionosphere is in constant flux. It changes not only with time of day, but also with time of year. Now, I'm located about 20 miles south of Boston, and I like to listen to a radio station that's on 7.490 megahertz out of Monticello, Maine. This time of year, I can pick it up most of the time. They don't get on the air till about 4 o'clock our time anyways, but generally speaking, I can listen to WBCQ this time of year without any difficulty. However, once we start getting into October, November, December, the signal virtually just goes away. They have no problem hearing the signal in South America, but here, 20 miles south of Boston, the signal is 100 miles over my head, and I just can't get it. And I'm too far away from the station to pick up any ground wave signal, so I have to resort to listening on the computer, to the stream. But the ionosphere does change, and it also changes with time of day. Typically, on the shortwave bands, during daylight hours, at least here in New England, the higher frequencies from about 10 megahertz up come to life, and the lower frequencies are not quite as effective. And when you get to 4 o'clock, 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock, as the sun is heading down over the horizon, the whole thing shifts, and the upper end of the band from 10 megahertz up kind of goes dark, and the low end of the band from 10 megahertz down. 10 megahertz is good pretty much 24 hours a day. From 10 megahertz down, as the sun goes down, the signal quality greatly improves on the lower end of the shortwave bands, from the AM broadcast band right up through to 10 megahertz. So it's kind of like shooting at a moving target, and this is why your international shortwave stations broadcast on numerous frequencies
right.
at a time. You'll find back in the old days when the BBC transmitted all over the world, you would find a BBC signal on every major shortwave band. You would choose what frequency to listen to based on how good the
right.
reception is.
Right. I remember as a kid, you know, I would hunt around 15 meters. I would, you know, in the evenings, I would look around 49 meters. 31 meters was kind of an interim, you know, you'd sometimes, but I used to get their London Calling program guide, you know, and, you know, this mm-hmm. is back in the days when they actually took the, you could, I don't know, it was $5 or whatever. But you could not only see how they were broadcasting to North America, South and Central America, sometimes you could pick up stuff on the backside, you know, that they were broadcasting to Africa or to the Middle East, and, you know, they'd still mm-hmm. be broadcasting in English. So, you know, it's just another topic for another night. We talk about antennas and atmospherics, but I want to back up a little bit to get back to mm-hmm. The world of communications receivers.
Yeah.
Some of the manufacturers, who should we know? Hammerland, Collins, who else is in the mix? Hallicrafters is sort of a very popular name, and they
yep.
sort of a crossover company. You see them in the
yep.
consumer markets as well as the broadcast markets. Anybody else we should know about?
Well, probably, yeah. Hallicrafters is probably the most prolific of all the companies, and they made also the broadest spectrum of communications receivers. I have sitting, again, just a couple feet to my left here is a World War II vintage SX-28A, which was a very fine communications receiver with high-fidelity audio output.
Very nice.
And behind me on a shelf, I've got an SX-73, which was also known as an R-274 to the military. Those were very high-end radios. The R-274 in 1954 was $975. So it was a very expensive radio. But they also made, on the opposite end of that spectrum, they also made the S-38s, which were essentially about a $29 radio.
Starter kit for when you were in the shortwave ham radio club at high school. You know.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And National. National was also a very prolific manufacturer of communications receivers. They were located in Malden,
yep,
Massachusetts.
Malden, Mass, yep.
And they made, on the high end of things, they made the HROs, which were very heavily used during World War II. They made the HROs actually almost into the 1970s with the HRO-500, which was solid state. But on the opposite end of the spectrum from National was the SW-54, which is a little AC-DC operated five-tube metal-cased communications receiver, which you can carry under your arm. It's not very heavy. It's very small, but it's also they work fairly well. I mean, for a beginner getting into the hobby, those little radios work well. But going up the scale, you have Hammerland, you have Collins, as you mentioned, there were other manufacturers from other countries as well. There was Siemens from Germany, Telefunken from Germany, Raycal and Murphy from England.
Could you get a Heathkit?
Heathkit made boat anchors, absolutely. Absolutely. In fact, I when I was 13 years old, I built a Heathkit SB-310, which was the shortwave listening variant of the SB-300, which was a ham radio receiver. Again, it's a radio you can tuck under your arm and carry around with you, but it's a 12-tube double conversion receiver. It's a pretty high-end radio. Of course, you can also, you know, look at Nightkit and Ico, and all of those companies made their variants on the communications receivers as well. But if you were getting started or getting interested in acquiring a communications receiver, the one that I highly recommend and always recommend to people is the Hammerland HQ-129X. Came out of the market in 1946. It's an 11-tube single conversion receiver, and it came out of the market at $129, which is where the 129 came from. And you can pick them up at ham fests and flea markets for $50, sometimes less, sometimes a little bit more. And with a few hours of capacitor replacement and tube checking and some alignment, you'll have a radio that will satisfy most of your needs. It really is a very, very quality piece of equipment, and it was born from the loins of Hammerland, which was, again, probably one of the best communications receivers manufacturers around.
I love that, Pros. You should have been a writer with Pros like that. I'm going to interrupt you for just a moment because we need to remind everyone, if you've wondered where good manners and civility still exist on the radio, wonder no more. You have found Radio Paradise. It's Tube Talk on WRCA 1330 AM, where we play some music. We have nifty conversations with people who are still interested in radio and listen to radio and restore radios and know a lot more than I do about radio. And, you know, I just, as we have the conversation, and it's funny because you have this stuff in your head, you're an enthusiast on it, it to some people might sound like a lot of alphabet and numeric soup. So they say, well, why do I really want to listen to one of these? So I'm going to just relate a vignette, some anecdotal evidence. I might have mentioned this to you. I saw online there's a company that does, they sell tubes, they sell restored radios. They're down in Texas, but I'll let them remain nameless. And they had a Collins on their site for sale, and the guy was marveling about it. And he, you know, he was so interested in it, he did some research on it, yada, yada, yada. Anyway, so he's talking about how they were considered for use in the first wave of Desert Storm because the solid-state equipment wasn't working right, but yet these were testing and working right. And on he goes. And then he begins to talk about listening to the broadcast band on it. And he said, you know, I'm in this building, you know, we're in a fairly metropolitan area. Stations that when he would listen on his regular equipment, you know, he can't null things out. He's getting all kinds of static. He's getting, you know, stations bleeding all over each other. The static is all gone. The stations sound like locals coming in. He was absolutely floored by the performance of the device. And, yeah, you know, it might not be something you'd want to put in the living room like a neat old Zenith console or a nice Philco console and say, isn't that pretty to look at? And not to say that they wouldn't be good performers in their own right. Sometimes the performance on the communications receivers is just so outstanding, it's overwhelming. And this is overwhelming to people who've even been in the hobby, though they've worked mostly with commercial type sets for most of their life. So maybe you could give us an idea. What was one of your best listening experiences when you said, wow, I didn't believe I could hear that, or that just sounded so incredible. I've never heard that station or that signal come in that good.
It's not necessarily so much about the listening experience, because all of the listening experience is always pleasurable with these radios. And that was something I wanted to shift over to a little bit, was it's not just the listening to these things that's pleasurable. There's a certain satisfaction that comes from taking one of them apart and doing a restoration that's totally different from doing a Zenith console or doing a Philco console. These radios were actually designed to be taken apart and to be worked on and to be put back together and so forth. So the restoration part of it, to me, is as enjoyable, if not more so, than the actual listening. But you're right in saying that these radios have an ability to pull signals out of the dirt much better than your commercial radios of the time. Although, you know, you could sit down here with my Murphy B40, which is a fantastic radio made by a British company called Murphy. These actually came out just after World War II. There's a certain quality listening to something like that, as opposed to, say, a Zenith or a Philco console. But the difference in circuitry design, if you go back into 1938, 39, and 40, the circuitry design between those console radios and the communications receivers of the time wasn't that far removed.
Mm-hmm.
And if you take a 10 or a 12-tube Zenith and put it next to, you know, an AR-88, which was an RCA model communications receiver, you probably would be shocked at how close behind the AR-88 one of your consoles comes, because the engineering was all about on the same level at that point in time. The engineers that were designing the console radios were the same guys that, you know, turned their hat around and designed the communications receivers as well. So a lot of the developments that were going on in radio, they were primarily happening in the communications receiver department, but a lot of those little tricks were getting forwarded over to the commercial department as well. They adopted some of that technology at that point in time.
I think what you're really alluding to, and I'll just for the audience, is, you know, what Ross is saying, not only appreciating them for the listening, but appreciating them for their design. You know, they were really designed to be serviced in the field, which is why when you see a lot of these things, they look, you know, they have the handles. You'd pull them out of the rack. Mm-hmm. They were made to be serviced, so they're laid out a little differently. You know, things are much more, I noticed just casually, things seem to be much more square. You know, when you lift off the cover from the chassis, it's a totally different layout because you're not trying to form something that you can fit into a wooden cabinet that might be a tombstone shape or a cathedral shape or a funky shape. And it's just to appreciate the engineering that went into these things and maybe even to kind of put yourself into the shoes of some guy who had to field service something like this during the war. You know, my dad had a friend from World War II. He was in the Navy with him, and he worked for the light company up here for years and years and years. But the guy was a real fixer. He could fix just about anything, and he was a radio tech in the service. And he fixed a set for me when I was a kid, but my father would say, you know, not only could he fix it, he said he could probably fix it in a foxhole for you if he had to. So you kind of think about the pressure on somebody if they were on an island they had just stormed and their radio is kaput, and now, okay, get Johnny over here. I hope he can figure it out, because otherwise it could be a long wait for air cover. So it's a very different perspective, too, when you think about what they were really used for and how they got their start.
Well, one of the things that was a definite improvement following World War II was you started seeing these radios being designed in a modular type of setup.
I think that's what I was trying to say. Yep.
Yeah, the Collins radios, the R390, the 390A. If you had a radio fail out in the field, you could narrow it down to one module, pull a module out, swap it out with a module that you got from Supply Depot, and you'd be back in operation, which was not something that was true with things like the BC-348 and the RBM, RBA, RBB, RBC series, which were used on the battleships during World War II. Although the RBB and RBC radios did have somewhat modular design. The RF and the IF modules were separate, and they were interchangeable. But that's where they started heading in that direction. I actually have two sets of those here. And if you had an RBA, which covered from 10 kilohertz to 600 kilohertz, and an RBB, which is 600 kilohertz to 4 megahertz, and then an RBC, which is 4 to 27 megahertz, that combination of those three radios was $10,000 in 1940. They were very expensive radios, and a typical battleship would have five radio rooms with two setups in each radio room.
Yeah,
and that doesn't include transmitters, the TDQs and TDXs and so forth of that time period. I don't know my transmitters as well, but you did see a lot of developments happening with modular design. right next to my knee, here, mounted in a rack on my table in the shop here, is a R1051B. And this is a radio that came out in 1967 at a cost of $25,250.
Oof.
Uncle Sam paid a ton of money for these things. And this thing is designed, it's mostly solid state. There's two tubes in it. The rest of it's all solid state. It even has IC chips in it. For the translator module.
Quite a hybrid.
Oh, it's unbelievable. And you can slide this thing out. You can pull two little clips and tilt the chassis up to get to the bottom of it. And it's a bunch of little boxes bolted onto a main chassis. So if you had a problem in the field with this radio, you two screws, out comes the module, you drop another module in, and you're back in operation.
Well, we know what a boat anchor is. We know why we should be interested in communications receivers. We learned about some of the major manufacturers. We learned about some of the better performing models. So, you know, we'll come back to this. We'll have you on again, and maybe we can talk a little bit about antennas and atmospherics, and we'll route it all back into the world of communications receivers. But thanks an awful lot for taking some time with us. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much, and good luck with the show.
Take care, Ross. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
It's the Les Paul Show. We call it the Les Paul Show with Mary Ford. You can call it transcribed because here it is, hot out of a recording machine. And here's the guitar himself, Les Paul.
Hi. Well, I've got my guitar and I'm here. I guess I ought to mention that my name is Les Paul and that the other half of the act, my wife, Mary, she's usually here to sing some songs, but something's happened. Well, she just hasn't showed, so I'll carry on the best I can. A couple of things are missing tonight. One is my invention, the Les Pulverizer. That's a gadget I invented. I've been using it on the show here. By plugging my electric guitar into it, it makes it it multiplies it until I have a full orchestra of guitars. And if you sing into it, it makes one voice into 15, 20, or as many as you can stand. Well, they're both missing, and I'll be doggone if I know what's happened. Now, if someone hadn't stole my electric Les Pulverizer, I'd be sitting here strumming this one guitar and it'd sound like six. It's a good old tune. Remember Avalon? Sure wish Mary'd get here and she could help me find that high-volt rustler who stole my gadget. I guess I'll stay on this. It sounds good. Sure rough to be sitting around here with just one microphone, trying to be a normal individual, one guitar. You know, now that I think of it, Mary's been acting kind of strange lately, asking a lot of questions about that invention of mine, and she's been making a lot of trips down. Say, I'll bet you I know where she is. Wait a minute. Excuse me, folks. Mary! Mary!
Are you calling me that?
Mary, are you down in the basement?
Basement.
Well, how do you like that? You can't trust these women. Mary Ford, you get up here this minute with my pulverizer.
Okay, I'm coming up. I didn't know you were looking for me.
Les.
How corny can you get? And Mary, quit twisting those dials.
What happens if I turn this dial?
What?
What'd you say?
I was gonna say, leave that dial alone.
Your voice is definitely too high.
Oh, me.
Well, hello, Amos. Where's Andy?
Mary, I'm telling you, you're going to bust something.
Hey, here's one I haven't tried.
Mary!
Would you repeat that?
Mary!
What is it, Jack?
What a commotion. Why does everything have to happen to me? I wonder if Edison or Benjamin Franklin went through a thing like this.
Benjamin Franklin was a great man. He discovered electricity.
He did, huh? Well, what about the guy that discovered the meter? He's the one that made all the money. The best thing you can do is loosen up those straps and take that Les Pulverizer off your back. And don't forget to pull the AC plug out of the wall before you get a shock.
Never mind.
Here, let me help you with that.
I got it on and I can wiggle out of it.
You aren't a sight for sore eyes trying to wiggle out of that gadget. You look like a hula dancer.
Do I really? Ta-wa-ila-ta-wa-wa-ila.
Oh, Mary. You act so silly.
Now with my Mary Forderizer, I throw this switch, and now I'm three.
Ta-wa-ila-ta-wa-wa-ila. Hey,
pay a koalula.
Come on, Les, grab a guitar. I'll make you sound like Four Fred Waring.
Well, he doesn't even play the guitar. He plays the banjo.
Toot-a-toot-a-la, topi-topi, I'm a lepa wai topi la. Ta-wai-la, ta-wa-wai-la, e-wing-a-la, pay-a-ko-a-lu-a-la. Toot-a-toot-a-la, topi-topi, I'm a lepa wai topi la.
Is Tom Swift's electric grandmother, Mary Ford. Yes. Mary, my advice to you is to toss a guitar over your back to protect yourself from buckshot and head west in a boat loaded with pineapple for that beautiful island.
Les, help me, help!
What, Mary, what's the matter?
I don't know. Your machinery is starting to smoke and I can't get it off my back. Undo the straps, Les.
Come on over here and I'll help you. Didn't I tell you something would happen?
Yes, Les, I'm sorry. I'll never do it again. Please hurry, please.
And you promise never again to fool with my inventions?
Yes, I promise.
And will you remember that it's the Les Pulverizer and not the Mary Forderizer?
Yes, I know. I'm sorry.
Okay, well, turn around. Oh, there you are.
Thank heavens, I'll never do this again.
That'll teach you to stay away from my inventions. Well, now to grab my guitar here. Got to plug it into the Les Pulverizer. I got to set all these dials over again. You twisted them and you were going haywire. Now, let me see. I got to do this. There you are. Now, I'll put a wire on here. Oh, here's the trouble. There you are. Three guitars. Still isn't any bass, so there's something. Oh, here it is. Now watch the bass. Yeah, that's better. Boy, this thing is sure messed up. Yeah, that's better. Yeah, this is a good tune, you know. Maybe the folks would like to hear it all the way through.
Good. What was the name of it?
Where or When.
I liked it.
Mary, tell me, as my wife, are you tired of playing second fiddle to the guitar?
If it were just your guitar, it wouldn't be so bad. But having our lives centered around these crazy electrical gadgets...
I think I see your point. I've just made a decision. I'm through with electronics. No more electrical gadgets for me.
Really?
Yep.
Oh, I'm so glad.
Well, I felt for a long time that you've been fed up with this stuff, so I've decided to call it quits.
Well, good.
Which reminds me, why did you ever go down in the basement with that gadget in the first place?
Well, I thought if the thing could make one guitar sound like six...
Yes?
I could plug in my new Hoover vacuum cleaner and clean the house six times as fast.
Yes, you would think of something like that.
And by equalizing the output and connecting the grid
I understand.
Two...
Thank you, Miss Vacuum Cleaner of 1950. Now she pauses in her work to sing a song that swept the nation a few years back. I'll see you in my dreams.
The corn's sure popping now.
Here's your broom, gal. Sing.
Now?
Now.
I'll see you in my dreams. Hold you in my dreams. Someone took you.
Well, thank you, Les, but I can't take the credit. I stand here and sing into a microphone, and there's 12 other voices on there I had nothing to do with.
No.
You're over there turning your dials and fooling with wires and playing the guitar. And
no more electric wires for me. I'm done with them, believe me.
I can't believe you're serious.
I'm going to join Wires Anonymous.
Oh, but Les, you'd miss all that.
No. I made up my mind, so you can help me by not mentioning anything about it. I'm done. Someone's at the door. Would you answer it, please? Let's see. Oh, yeah, I was talking about electrical gadgets. Well, I'm going to join this club, Wires Anonymous. That's quite a place, see. No wire, no electronics. Don't dare mention it.
It's Western Union, Les.
Oh?
Are you Les Paul?
Yeah.
I have a wire for you.
Wire? Don't even mention that name around here. Who sent you, Alvino Ray? Good night, folks.
Good night.
Thanks again for listening to Tube Talk. Good night, everybody. Drop us an email, tubetalk1@gmail.com.
Listening to the Les Paul Show, a transcribed illusion made up of one part Les Paul on the guitar and one part Mary Ford on the vocals. Both parts coming to you from Hollywood's Radio City. This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.
Bye-bye.
All WRCA programs are brought to you by independent producers and their sponsors, who are entirely responsible for their content. For information on how you can produce and host your own program on this station, contact our station manager for available times and rates at 617-492-3300.